to be head out now. I wish I knew how. Your eyes are like starlight now.
Hi, and welcome to True Crime Breweries, episode number 3 of the 12 Beers of Christmas.
How's everyone doing? Hope you're not too tired of us yet.
So, today's episode is about the 1913 Italian Hall disaster or massacre, depending on where you read about it. This is the third episode, as I said. If you haven't heard episode 1 and episode 2, please go back and listen to those first. If you're not aware, there's going to be one episode a night until Christmas. It's going to be the 12 Beers of Christmas. So Dick's going to review a beer, and I'm going to start on the crime. We'll talk about the crime.
Well, we want a 5-star review first, right?
Oh, yeah, I'm going to do that. And it's a Christmas beer, of course, right?
Well, it has to be.
Okay, so I'll read the 5-star review. So this is called Informative and Laid Back by Denver, Colorado Reviewer.
I'm guessing he lives in Denver.
I'm guessing. Or she.
Or she.
I came across True Crime Brewery while on the hunt for a new true crime podcast, as I listened to podcasts all day long at work. I quickly found myself binge listening to the show. Jill and Dick are great hosts who bring great insight, empathy, and hard facts. Not to mention the audio quality is superb, and I love the opening and closing music. Reminds me of a mystical Harry Potter theme. I myself am not a drinker, but I'm always interested what brews Dick will have selected for the episode, as he does a wonderful job describing him. So, Denver, Colorado reviewer, welcome to the brewery.
That's a wonderful review.
Yes, thank you. That was a very nice review. What do we have for our Christmas beer?
So, this third Christmas beer, this is a cool one.
Okay.
The name of the beer is Lump of Coal.
Nice.
Okay. So that's what all the bad boys and girls get for Christmas.
I like that.
It's
cool.
Brewed by Ridgeway Brewing, and it's an English beer from South Stoke, England. So Lump of Coal is a foreign or export stout, which tends to be a bigger stout than the normal stout, higher in alcohol, with a pronounced roasted character. So Lump of Coal is a dark brown color with some red highlights. It's got a roasted malt and faint chocolate aroma, a chocolate and coffee taste, just a hint of hops. It's kind of thin on the mouthfeel. It's certainly not that of a stout or even a mild stout, but it's an okay beer. Not
okay.
One of my favorites. I just love the title.
Well, yeah, and you wouldn't give a Lump of Coal as a favorite anyway.
Right.
All right. That's kind of, for the bad boys and girls, they don't get the best stout.
No.
Sure.
They get the Lump of Coal.
Absolutely. So it makes sense.
All right.
Well, let's open the beer.
Let's pop this top and head down to the quiet end.
Okay, Dick, let's go down to the quiet end of the bar to talk about the 1913 Italian Hall massacre.
All right.
Anybody down there?
Well, you know, surprisingly, because on the one hand, I know it's early, but on the other hand, I know things start after Thanksgiving.
Right.
There's a Santa suit guy sitting down there.
Oh, a department store Santa.
I would imagine, because yeah. He's not the real Santa.
That makes me think of Bad Santa with Billy Bob Thornton.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, although this guy is not drunk.
Well... not like Billy Bob. He might have had a few.
Yeah, but Billy Bob in Bad Santa, he was always wrecked when he was sitting at the
mess.
Bar.
Yeah, yeah.
At the same time, though, he got a lot of action.
He did.
So.
He was popular. He got cute bartender.
Yeah.
He got the big women in the, you know, the queen size department store section.
He was a mover and a shaker.
Quite literally.
But this guy just looks like he's finished his shift and he's just relaxing.
Yeah, and he's got a nicer suit. Nice fresh beard.
Yeah.
Rosy cheeks. I'm kind of looking forward to sitting near him.
He looks more real.
Yeah.
Let's go sit next to him and see what we can do.
Okay, let's go.
Okay. So the Italian Hall disaster, which is sometimes referred to as the 1913 massacre, was a tragedy that occurred on Christmas Eve 1913 in Calumet, Michigan. Now, Calumet is way the hell out there on the Upper Peninsula.
Very remote, yeah.
Very remote.
Yeah.
73 mostly striking mine workers and their families were crushed to death in a stampede when somebody falsely shouted fire at a crowded Christmas party.
Yeah, well, 6 months without work left many miner families with little food for the holidays.
I can imagine.
No money for presents. So the Ladies Auxiliary of the Western Federation of Miners held a Christmas party for the kids. Now 500 children and 200 adults showed up that day for the party. It was held on the second floor of Calumet's Italian Hall, and the only way in or out was this very steep stairway. So as darkness fell and people began to go home to their family celebrations, some of the children had gathered around the stage because presents were being passed out.
Yeah, and it was probably going to be the only present they were getting.
It's really sad, yeah. For many, it would be the only gift they'd received that year. And in the middle of this festive celebration, someone, and we know what it's thought to be, what kind of person they thought it was.
Yeah, one of the union people. But somebody, anyway, yelled out, or somebody or some bodies, maybe more than one.
Yelled out fire, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that caused a panic.
It did. Chaos ensued, and everybody headed down the stairs to the exit. But the doors were blocked from the outside. And even if they had been able to back up and pull on the doors, so it would have been really hard to do when you have people rushing for it.
Yeah. I mean, there's this throng of people trying to get out and pushing on the doors. And they open inside, so nobody's going to open the doors.
Well, and it's believed by many that the doors were held closed on purpose.
Yeah, so maybe they couldn't have opened the doors anyway.
No.
But that seems like a really shitty way to do things. I mean, if that
more than shitty
actually occurred, I mean, there were kids there. Most of the people there were kids.
Right. It's horrible.
Yeah.
Well, back in July of 1913, over 7,000 miners struck the C&H Copper Mining Company in Calumet, Michigan. So they went on strike. It was largely the usual issues of people who worked for a big company during the time when capitalists ran roughshod over their workers. Now, this was a time when monopolies were a way of life. Strikers' demands included pay raises, an end to child labor and safer conditions, including an end to one-man drill operations, as well as support beams in the mines. That doesn't seem like too much to ask.
No, and neither does one-man drill operations. I mean, those are just accidents waiting to happen.
What are those? What does that mean?
It means that there's one guy working the drill, trying to get the ore out.
By himself.
By himself.
Wow.
So why wouldn't you have two people?
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
And for sure, why wouldn't you have support beams?
Well, mine owners didn't want to because support beams were costly. But miners had been killed in cave-ins, and actually one of the mining company guys had said that cave-ins don't cost us anything, but beams do. Because that's how little they regarded the lives
right.
of their workers.
I mean, so what if somebody gets killed?
We'll just get someone else.
We've got plenty of people because it's 1913, early 1900s, people need work, so we can always find people to work,
sure.
even if we lose a few.
Yeah.
Horrible.
Well, this mining company, C&H, it was the largest copper mining company in the country, and it was up in the Keweenaw Peninsula, northwestern Michigan, and this was one of the longest strikes in copper country that took place. And it included all of the C&H mines, not just those. So the Western Federation of Miners first established a local in the area of 1908, but it wasn't until 1913 that they were large enough to officially strike. So I think one of us said earlier that it was one of the union people that held the doors, but we misspoke.
We did.
Yeah, it was someone with the mining company
right.
that did that. I don't know why. Just to be mean, it seems like.
Well, the workers weren't playing the game.
Right. So maybe it was just a harsh warning?
That went really wrong.
Yeah, yeah. So, there was a poorly marked fire escape on one side of the building, and there were ladders down the back of the building that could be reached by climbing out the windows. But when the incident began, there were about 400 people in the room, and they just ran down those stairs, which was the way they came in, so that makes sense.
Why wouldn't you go that way?
So, 73 people, including 59 children, were killed on this day.
Yeah, and they were all...
Christmas party.
They were crushed. It wasn't from smoke or fire or anything. They were crushed to death.
They were crushed, yeah. Yeah, so there has been a lot of debate about who cried fire and why. And some historians said that fire was called out by anti-union allies of mine management to disrupt the party. So there were several investigations into the disaster, and in the coroner's inquest, witnesses who didn't speak English were forced to answer their questions in English.
Well, that'd be tough.
Yeah, a lot of these people were Finnish immigrants that worked in the mines. So it appears that many of the people called to testify hadn't seen what happened, and after 3 days, the coroner issued a ruling that didn't give a cause of death. Just pretty much dropped it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, how can you not give a cause of death?
Right. So early in 1914, a subcommittee of the U.S. House of Representatives came to the Copper Country to investigate the strike, and they took sworn testimony from witnesses for a full day. Now, 20 witnesses testified under oath and were offered interpreters. 8 witnesses swore that the man who first cried fire was wearing a Citizens Alliance button on his coat. Now, what was Citizens Alliance?
Yeah, what was that?
I don't know. I thought you were going to know.
I guess it's someone who's not union.
I guess so. So, a common story regarding the tragedy states that the doors at the bottom of the stairs opened inward. And according to the story, when the fleeing partygoers reached the bottom of the stairs, they just were pressed up against it. So there was nowhere to go once you were there. Because
right.
You had a crowd of people up against you.
Well, even with that, I would think that there'd be some way to get the doors a little bit moved inward.
Yeah.
To get people out. So my thinking, as you said, was that the doors were blocked.
Yeah.
And you couldn't open them.
I think so. It seems that way. Now, a book was written called Death's Door, The Truth Behind Michigan's Largest Mass Murder. And this pointed out that the doors weren't mentioned as a contributing factor at the time. And the book also included blueprints of the building that were drawn by an architect, showing the locations and configurations of the doors, the staircase, and the landings. There was also a recent book by Allison K. Hoagland called Mine Towns. And in that book, she alleges that there were two sets of doors opening into a vestibule, and that the outer doors opened outward, and there may have been a set of inner bifold doors that they were trapped against.
Well, I mean, either way, there were doors that opened in that couldn't be opened.
Right. So in support of this, Allison Hoagland notes that a newspaper article at the time of its dedication mentioned that there were safety doors, such as the ample main stairway, 2 fire escapes, and all doors open outward. So she notes that the club had previously been cited for the predecessor building for having doors that opened inward. And further, she opines that the foreshortened stereopticon photo was impossible and misleading. So she further noted that according to the pro-company Daily Mining Gazette paper, they opened outward, which I don't know how much credit you would give to that.
I don't know that I'd give any credit to that.
So after the first wave of grief had passed following the incident, there was a bitterness against the company, and it was considerably greater against the Citizens Alliance, which opposed the union and the strike. So that answers our question about the badge.
Right.
These were people who opposed the strike.
Yeah.
So it was widely believed that the man who had yelled fire was wearing the badge. It was the Western Federation of Miners president, Charles Moyer, who publicized that accusation. And he actually refused to retract it, even though he was under a great deal of pressure. The New York Times reported that the Alliance members who served on the relief committee learned that Moyer had forbidden them from taking the funds that were promised to them. So they were promised aid to the bereaved families.
Huh.
So it just seems like it's all around a horrible thing.
Some cover up there, huh?
Yeah. But I just can't imagine losing children like that on Christmas Eve. That's horrible.
No.
So the Italian Hall was actually demolished in October of 1984, and they did keep the archway. It's a state historical marker, and the site is in a park maintained by the Keweenaw National Historical Park. And the marker actually incorrectly states that the tragedy was partially caused by inward opening doors. Ella Reeve Bloor was present at the disaster and puts forth her own version in her autobiography. Her telling is problematic, though, because she claims that she was near the stage when the panic occurred, but no witnesses ever testified to her presence there. It was definitely a tragic event that should have been prevented, it sounds like.
Sounds like. The disaster generated a fair amount of scholarly debate. A historian named Arthur Thurner, who wrote a book, Rebels on the Range, The Michigan Copper Miners Strike, raises the possibility that there were actually might have been a fire in another part of the hall, perhaps the chimney of the building. Perhaps the strongest argument, though, against an actual fire is that none of the investigations found any witnesses who would claim there was a fire. And the fire log of the Red Jacket Fire Department, who responded to the call, said there was no fire.
So we have no evidence of any fire?
None.
Okay. And nobody died of smoke or fire, obviously.
They right.
were crushed.
They were crushed.
I imagine some of them suffocated. Is that part of what happens?
Yes.
Yeah.
So there's a book called Death's Door, The Truth Behind Michigan's Largest Mass Murder, which concludes that the culprit was most likely an ally of mine management.
Right.
But he did exhaustive interviews and reports and transcripts.
Who, the author?
The author.
Yeah.
And didn't find any evidence that it was a calculated act by the mine management.
Well, no, they never sent anyone to trial.
Right.
And there was never any civil case either, which is strange. I think if it happened contemporarily, there would definitely be a civil suit and more of an investigation.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
But again, this was over 100 years ago.
True.
So they didn't do that stuff.
Well, plus I would throw out there that these were poor people, poor immigrants.
Right.
So it wasn't given the attention.
And as you said, there's more of them in the wings, so we can always find another one willing to work.
Right, right. That's a sad thing. I'd like to ask all of our listeners to complete a short survey for us. This survey can help us to get sponsors. Our show will never be inundated with ads, but I'd like to add one or two to help out in supporting the podcast. So please go to survey.libsyn.com/tiegrabber or follow us on Twitter at tiegrabberpods. Or on our Instagram, Tiegrabber Podcasts, or on Facebook by going to tiegrabber.com/Facebook. And I'll post the survey link there. Now, it really, honest to God, takes less than 2 minutes, and it's a huge help if you just would fill that out. Also, if you enjoy the podcast, we would really appreciate it if you would leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. Now, I realize not everyone is on iTunes, but a majority of our listeners are. And if we get the 5-star reviews, that's what really helps us to find new listeners, expand our listening audience. So I know it can kind of be a pain to leave a review on iTunes. They make you go through some steps. But if you have some time, you know, at work, it's a slow time, or you're watching TV, if you could just go online and do a quick review. It doesn't have to be long.
Drop us a line. Come
on. Just say I like the podcast, something like that.
That's all it takes.
You sound desperate, like you're just begging for help.
Oh, please, help me.
Okay. Well, thanks for listening. Happy holidays. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Okay.
No cabs to be had out now. I wish I knew how. Your eyes are like